Good afternoon. This is Ann Holland of Vert Marketing Sherpa, and welcome to our live annual teleseminar. This is actually the fourth annual of our research results from our email marketing benchmark guide. This is the benchmark guide for 2006. And joining me this afternoon is our research director, Stefan Tornquist. Hey, Stefan.
Hi, Ann.
I heard that apparently when a lot of people saw the ad we've been running on our newsletters and on our site, the announcement to sign up for this teleseminar, that quite a few people were shocked because they'd seen your name, Stefan Tornquist, thought that you were Swedish and assumed you were a blonde.
Yes, I heard that as well. I have no data on that. Maybe we could move on.
I guess that's one of those things. I often meet people at conventions and conferences, and you do. I do so many of these teleconferences and so many virtual things in today's world, and it's always surprising when you see what people look like in real life. So it's kind of neat. Well, here is some real life data for everybody on email marketing. Now, real quick, Stefan, can you tell me all of the data that is going to be presented today and the data that indeed is actually in the actual email benchmark guide? Where is all that data coming from?
Sure. Maybe everybody could turn to slide number 2 in our presentation, and this gives us the rundown. And basically, we try to get information from three major sources. The first is our own in-depth survey of email marketers, and this year we had, I think, 1,927 email marketers responded to our survey, business-to-business, business-to-consumer, and some mixed audience marketers, those in agencies. So that's our number one source. Number two, we generate a number of independent research studies with various partners. Some we do ourselves, some we do with partners. In some cases, we'll go out and ask a question of the community and see who can find the best answer. And in this report, there are, I believe, 25 of these studies that vary in size and scope. But one example, as we can see the image on the bottom, is our eye tracking study of emails this year. That is an example of one of those studies. Finally, we look at the best of research from all of the secondary sources out there. Sometimes it's something that's been published already, but more often it's something that we know exists, and we'll go out to those research vendors, usability labs, et cetera, and go and get that information for this guide.
That's cool. And just to give people a feeling for who all these email marketers are who are providing a lot of the data, what is the average amount of money that an email marketer who gave us their real-life data for this report, what is the average amount of money they're spending on email a year?
Well, one thing we know is the percentage of their marketing budget that they're spending on email, and mm-hmm. we know that it's roughly twice the industry average. The person's reading this guide and supplying information for the survey are typically twice as involved. About 15% of their online marketing budgets are going to email, as opposed to 7 to 9% of the average.
And they're spending, on average, how much money?
And they are spending, on average, well, this varies quite a lot, but it's well over $150,000.
So these are major mailers who have pretty decent data to share.
Indeed.
Okay. Well, why don't we move on? This is slide number 3 or page number 3 if you're looking at a printout of the PDF. Now, Stefan, can you explain why we see this almost alarming thing going on here, which is that open rates across email appear to be falling? Is this terribly alarming?
Well, it's certainly true. Whether it's alarming depends on your point of view. But as we look at the numbers across all email campaigns, open rates dropped, and it's a very rough average, of about 20%. And it's certainly notable because in a medium that's been around for a long time, you don't typically see shifts of that scale. You know, you see 1% or 2% shifts over the course of a year. And so a 20% jump or drop, rather, is a big deal. But what we've certainly found, and a number of other studies have found as well, is that this is the result of filtering concerns, that HTML emails, which count opens, are being filtered or blocked, rather, mm-hmm. and so that it's impossible to actually get an accurate count of those opens. So is it alarming? Perhaps. It's certainly not. The problem is not that 20% fewer people are opening their emails. The problem is that we're 20% less capable of counting it.
Now, there's one side note to this, of course, which is if you're seeing this 20% drop in open rates, that, as you said, indicates a lot more people aren't seeing the HTML version or the perfect HTML of the email you just sent out. And yet most marketers are sending out, you know, nice HTML images, graphics in their email. And this points out the ever-increasing, dramatically increasing need to include text links in your email. So if you just have a button for someone to click on, make sure there's an actual text link underneath it or something that will show up if someone does not see the image. Also, just take a look at your email. What does it look like if it displays with the images broken or if it displays in text only? A lot of marketers, this drives me nuts, a lot of marketers depend on their email software or their email service provider to sort of in an automated fashion create a text-only version. So what they do is they hand over this lovely, beautiful HTML, and then they say, oh, and yeah, I'll let the system kind of create a text version of that as well. And they sort of figure, well, hardly anyone's going to see that, so I don't need to worry about what it looks like. Well, actually, you have to worry about what that looks like because more people are seeing it, perhaps 20% more, than you think are. So you got to make sure that looks good, too, and it works, and the links work, and they aren't broken, they're not nasty and long, you know, they're shorter than 60 characters, things like that. So text actually matters now more than ever. And why don't we move on to the next chart? This is happy, happy news.
Yes, it is. In click rates, the only real movement we see are at the top and the bottom of the spectrum, and you'd expect to see those very high click rates over 21%. You'd expect to see that drop over time. And that's what we are seeing. But the really good news is that the click rates in the lowest range, 0 to 2%, those are falling as well. So even though email maybe not be as exciting as it was a few years ago, it's also being practiced better, at least as click-through rates are showing. You know, people are hitting those averages between 3 and 15% more and more as time goes on.
Now, and you do have in the report, you actually do have data on, you know, B2B versus B2C and e-retail and things like that, so people know what the click rates are for different
industries. Oh, absolutely.
Good. It is worth noting, by the way, that these click-through rates are, they are a percent of email sent, are they not?
Correct. Because there are so many different ways for counting deliverables. We choose to use the very simplest definition, which is clicks as a representation of the total email sent.
Right. So you don't want to, if your email reports show click rates as a percent of email delivered, that actually is very definitely, almost definitely a false number because you really don't know how many of your emails are actually really, really delivered. You just know how many emails didn't hard bounce. You don't know how many emails got past filters unless you're using usually a separate filter auditing service to track that as well. And we do have information on that. If you want information on filter auditing services, just contact customer service. I think they have a list of them for you. Why don't we move on? Now, this is the next slide is about conversion rates. Stefan, can you first define what you mean by a conversion rate? What's that a percent of?
Sure. Well, that's a percent of the people who interacted. So in the case of most email campaigns, it's the percentage of people who clicked, the number of unique clicks divided by the number of people who took that action. In the guide, we look at conversion rates, which are purchases, and also at those which are lead gen, which is, of course, in business-to-business, so often the conversion goal.
Okay, so this is not, though, math from the email sent. It is simply once people click, what percent then actually do anything?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, the one thing that I've noticed is that with the increased attention on landing pages, that a lot of email campaigns are getting better and better landing pages, and I think that may be part of what's changing stuff. Marketers are now knowing that if they have a headline or specific images in the email campaign they're running, the more absolutely precisely they can match that in the landing page for that click, the more likely they are to convert people. Are there any other trends that you see that have been affecting those conversions and helping them go up, Stefan?
Well, there's certainly been in the movement towards getting better qualified lists, you've seen a lot of the folks that weren't seeing very successful list rental campaigns have actually stopped using them.
Mm-hmm.
And those that continue to use them are giving them slightly better grades. So even though that's a part of the industry that still needs a lot of work,
mm-hmm.
I do believe that for this is the first year in four that we've seen list rentals get slightly better marks year over year. So I do think that there's some action on the side of the industry itself, that the lists that are being sold are actually of slightly higher quality, and that people are now cognizant that if you're paying 5 cents, $1,000 for CEO names, you're probably not getting the best quality. People understand now that.
But these are conversion rates not just for rented list campaigns. These are conversion rates for house list campaigns, too.
Absolutely. But among the many factors, I think that's one.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, landing pages have gotten a lot more attention over the last 18 months, and I do think that that's playing a role.
Mm-hmm. I'm hearing about a lot of people now who are, of course, the big trend now is to be running multivariate testing on your landing page. In particular, a really high-impact landing page, which would be, a house list. It's your most valuable list. An email offer going to a house list that's, an incredibly powerful page to test. And people are running A-B tests and multivariate tests on that particular page, learning how to convert their most valuable list better, and then taking the lessons they learned from that page and kind of transferring them across other pages. So you may not have the budget to be able to run tests on every page you ever do for anything, but taking lessons and moving them about, because what works for your most valuable list is probably what you want using for other things as well. So I'm seeing a lot of movement. It's fixating.
It is. And I should point out that our own research into conversion rates showed, and this is a conglomeration of many, many different charts because we look at conversion rate in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
We saw them up slightly. In some specific categories, we saw them drop. In others, we saw them go up. So it was really a case of holding the line, which is not such a bad thing.
Now, for the people who, 24 months ago, all we heard was email is dead. This is
exactly.
Really good news. Why don't we move on to page number 6. Now, this is, to me, perhaps the most startling data. I don't think I'd expected this data at all. I think all of us in email marketing, to some degree, feel like, we've been doing this forever. It's been since the 90s, and, everyone who started email newsletters, a lot of brands started them. Usually it was around, 2001, maybe 2002. And, we've all been growing our house list forever. And, consumers are tired of joining lists. There's sort of a feeling in the community that people are tired of opting in and don't want to be spammed or whatever. And gee whiz, hasn't the audience peaked? Maybe right now, I think my gut was perhaps we were all going to be kind of replacing names that were dropping off our list, but maybe not growing hugely. This chart shows that actually opt-in lists are growing tremendously.
Absolutely. If you look on the far right, and we're on, slide 6, you can see the three factors that go into this equation. 5.2%, that's the growth per month of the average list, and that's much stronger than we had expected.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, the average list is losing about 2%, so that gives us about 3.2% per month growth for the average list. And as you can see with the various verticals that were explored in this study, mm-hmm. It varies quite a lot. In manufacturing, for instance, very loyal house lists and fairly small lists, that's got the highest retention rate, losing less than 1% per month,
mm-hmm.
compared to something much more fluid and volatile like media and publishing, where there's a lot of gain and a lot of loss every month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there were two things that really startled me about this particular area, which was, in particular, media and publishing. The publishers of the world, from mainstream newspapers, trade magazines, often trade journals, got email newsletter religion to some degree fairly late in the game. Websites such as The Onion and USA Today only added on email newsletters really in the last 12 months. So this is a new thing for them. I mean, unlike marketers who've been doing email for a long time, a lot of the other publishers haven't. And so we're seeing some real gain there. And, of course, they're trying to sell ads against those names. So, of course, they're just dying to ramp up the names because they're trying to, get some money off this thing from selling ads, and you have to have a nice fat circulation list to sell ads. But I've seen a real dismaying trend, and that is, especially for trade publishers, they'll get a sponsor. Some sponsor will come in and say, hey, I want to buy an ad on your email newsletter, and the publisher will say, well, you know, that ad sold out. And in certain niches, like especially IT publishing, and frankly in marketing to marketers, a lot of those are sold out months in advance, which means that what happens is, unlike print where you can just add a few more pages and you're in an email newsletter, you really can't add any more eye space. You're limited in that real estate. So what they do is they slam another list up. They say, okay, we're going to start a whole new newsletter, just by the way, that happens to be on the topic the sponsor, you know, the sponsor's industry is in, and we'll start just sending it to the same list that we already have. And we'll email all our subscribers and say, congratulations, you're so lucky, we've started a whole new newsletter, and we're going to start just sending it to you. And that's actually considered opt-out publishing. So in other words, these people never signed up for the new newsletter because they signed up for one newsletter, now the publisher is sending them other things in addition. I would actually warn advertisers, if you are running an ad in an email newsletter run by a media company, look at a couple of factors before you run the ad. Obviously, look at your clicks and your conversions very carefully. Also, look at what time of day they're mailing, because a lot of media companies, marketers usually know that you need to send between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. East Coast time to get any traction. A lot of media companies, though, are still sending pretty late in the day, and for most industry niches, that's not going to work well for your ad. Also, look at whether that list is truly, truly opt-in. Did they really ask for it, or were they just transitioned over from another list and just shoved onto this list willy-nilly? I think we're seeing a lot of opt-out here and a lot of people leaving lists because they're not as careful about opt-in. Now, rant over. The other thing I'm interested in here is the professional and social organizations having an extraordinarily high stick rate and the hugest opt-in rate. Is this things like LinkedIn and other social networking online, or is this trade associations, or is it both, Stephen?
It's both. Later this year, we're excited to do some follow-up research to this that will look into the nooks and crannies. But overall, this is very encouraging.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. People feel like they've opted into a community, and therefore they're sticking longer. That definitely is an interesting trend, especially if you're considering sponsoring something. Why don't we move on? Oh, this one's very interesting. Page 7, how do we define spam? Can you explain this?
Sure. Well, this is sort of a good news, bad news year in how consumers are dealing with spam. Across the bottom of this chart, we see typical definitions of spam, and the percentages show how many people agree with that is part of their own definition of spam. And the definitions on the left are very standard, exactly what you would expect, and matching the industry definition of spam. But if you look on the right-hand side, these are three definitions that really fall outside of the way that marketers would define spam.
Mm-hmm.
But consumers are starting to see it this way, and that's really is big news. For instance, from a company I do business with, but it comes too frequently, well, almost 60% of people said, yeah, that's spam. And, of course, the question mark here is, what is too frequently? You know, I have a sense for some or all of, the top-performing part of my list, maybe they are perfectly happy to get emails twice a month. But what about the majority of the list? You know, this is a very broad definition and one that's shared by a lot of consumers. At the same time, I once gave permission, but I no longer wish to receive. In other words, these are people who they would unsubscribe if they had the energy, but they don't bother.
Now, haven't we run in previous studies, there are lots of stats showing that the majority of people who don't want to get something anymore never bother to unsubscribe. They just keep on hit and delete, or they finally actually mark you as spam instead of unsubscribing?
Yes, that's true. A lot of people will stay on lists and delete them more or less out of hand, but will sort of lurk around waiting to see whether something arrives. And, of course, the really bad news is that a lot of people will just hit the this is spam button if they have a service like AOL or Gmail, et cetera, one of those that has a spam button option, because it's a one-click option, and
mm-hmm.
it's very straightforward. Those companies that are still seeing, a misnomer, but strong unsubscribe rates tend to be companies that have very strong brand presences where people are very trusting that unsubscribe will work. or ones where they have multiple newsletter outlets. For instance, Marketing Sherpa has a number of different newsletters. People will take the time to unsubscribe from one because they want to continue to receive another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get a lot of people who will sign up for three or four newsletters 1 week, and then a couple of weeks later, they kind of look them all over, and then they pick the two they want to stick with or the one they want to stick with. That makes sense.
Exactly.
Now, the one thing that's always startled me is how many marketers, when I'm on the phone interviewing them, and I'll say, so, you know, tell me about the, you know, the wonderful data from your email campaign, and they'll say, well, our biggest success metric is that we have a really low unsubscribe rate. And I'm like, that means nothing. Everybody has a low unsubscribe rate. I don't know anyone with, you know, single digits. Everyone's got single digits. That's really not a success metric. That's just a laziness metric.
Well, yeah. I do think that in the last year we've seen a lot of marketers get wise to the fallibility of unsubscribes and even of open rates as strong indications of success. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the one good part of the drop in open rates is that I think it's jarred a lot of marketers into using more substantial metrics like clicks and conversions, websites, visits from email, et cetera, as a real measure of their success.
Now, tell me about this last one, the 38%. I think a lot of us, it's kind of based on old fax marketing laws from the early 90s, we all thought that as long as you had a quote-unquote pre-existing business relationship with somebody, in other words, they had been a customer usually, you were allowed to market to them as much as you wanted to via fax. And then a lot of marketers kind of thought that about email and assumed there was that customers and consumers felt the same way, that by virtue of having had this pre-existing customer relationship, it was okay to email them and it would not guaranteed not be considered spam. This looks like 38% of people aren't agreeing with that.
No, absolutely not. It may be legal, but that doesn't mean that people accept the idea is true. If people subscribe to your email newsletter with the thought that they're going to be receiving, lists of stars that are getting married in the next month and they start getting subscription offers to People Magazine, they're not going to be happy, and 40% are going to consider it spam.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, this is actually good reasoning for when you do have opt-in at your site and you do plan to send sales alerts or offers and you also plan to send email newsletters, that you might want to make those two separate checkboxes because some people really like one and don't like the other, and you may be able to get people to sign up who otherwise might not sign up. They might not want the sales alerts, but they might be into the newsletter. Newsletter is going to be your one chance to be in their inbox.
Absolutely.
So to some degree, newsletters not quite as direct responsive because it's not a dedicated blast, but often the only thing they're going to pay attention to. So valuable real estate. Why don't we move on to the next chart? What's this about? How much does spam bother us?
Okay, well, I mentioned earlier there was bad news and good news. Well, this is sort of the good news.
Okay.
This question is one that the Pew folks in their Internet and American Life study have asked several years running, and they ask a number of questions around how people feel about different, whether it's spam, phishing, false positives. They ask them how they're responding in their lives to these phenomena. And in this case, they asked, are you less trusting of email because of spam? And this might not seem like a big drop from 62 down to 53 in the year, but it's both a substantial drop and it's interesting in that it's a drop at all. Because this question asks, are you less trusting? If it were to ask, do you use email less, then we wouldn't be surprised to see some drop. But here, because they're asking, are you less trusting, it's easy to lose trust. And yet people are having less of a negative reaction to spam year over year. And we know that that's not because they're receiving less. Overall, people are receiving roughly the same amount of spam that they did because on the one hand, some spam filtering measures are working. On mm-hmm. the other, spammers have turned up the volume. And so those two factors are sort of equalizing. So a 10% drop in the course of the year, quite a big change, and what we think is that this mirrors how people have felt over the years about a lot of marketing innovations, which have good and bad sides. There were the times that people weren't comfortable using their credit cards in restaurants, so it's kind of a rough analogy to that, that
mm-hmm.
now that email is such an integral part of something like 72% of the population's daily life, they're aware of spam. They're getting better and better at recognizing what's a scam, what's phishing, what's coming from a trusted source, what isn't. And so they're less worried, and their trust is less compromised.
Mm-hmm.
We expect this to continue, although not as dramatically, as Internet users are more and more experienced. One other thing that we found is that the more experienced someone is, the less bothered by things like spam and phishing they are. The newer to email and the Internet they are, the more bothered they are.
So after a while, you just laugh off those Nigerians.
You laugh off those Nigerians. You may get some filtering software of your own. Most importantly, you just get used to it. And something like phishing is not very scary to people who are very experienced with the Internet.
You know, in a way,
it's like
commuting traffic. You may not like the traffic when you have to commute, but you're still going to drive.
Right.
And email is something you're still going to use. Email, not dead yet. I feel like it's, you know, after especially the past couple of years where people were really saying, email's dead, email's dead, it's such a relief. It's like we're out into the clear again.
Email's not going anywhere. You know, there are a number of, every marketer now has to face, getting blogs and podcasts and online ads and so forth up and ready. You're not going to be able to say goodbye to email anytime soon.
Okay. Why don't we move on to the next chart on page 9. Are people aware of false positives? Now, real quick, for those who, the very few in the audience who may not know what a false positive is, that's when an email is marked as spam and perhaps sent into a junk mail folder or filtered so that it doesn't show up in the inbox, even though it isn't spam, even though it's perhaps something someone asked for.
So this is a consumer survey, and one way to know whether people are aware of the problem of false positives is to look at whether they check their spam in their bulk folder to find legitimate messages.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's quite encouraging that over half of the respondents said that yes, they at least occasionally looked through those folders. You know, that's only sort of good news for marketers, because if you're sales offer, which was expiring last week, has been sitting in a bulk folder for a couple of months, that's not such great news. But it is important that people in general are aware of false positives. All of the pressure over the last few years has been in stopping email spam, and as people become aware that they're missing important communications, at least it provides a little bit of a counterbalance so that those IT guys at corporations, so those ISPs, are at least working. So part of their effort is going towards ensuring that emails do get through that are supposed to.
Now, of course, this means that every single marketer out there right now should be, go glance at the top of your email creative. If you have templates that you routinely use for your newsletter, for your sales offers, glance at the top of it right away and check that you indeed have a little text link at the very top of the thing, before your logo, before all your beautiful, gorgeous HTML, that just says, click here to whitelist, this email message. It could say something, words to that effect, so that for the 52% of consumers who are occasionally diving into their junk mail folder, if they find your message in there, which they're likely sooner or later to do, they can click on that link right there at the top to make sure that it never shows up in the folder again. And it should go over to a link to hopefully a landing page you created on your site all about whitelisting. Here's if you're an AOL member, here's how you whitelist us. Here, if you're a, Hotmail user, here's how you whitelist us. This is basic stuff, and this should be part of your email template. Why don't we move on to the next page? This is absolutely, page 10, one of my favorite charts of all time. Now, this is actually a business-to-business. This is business-to-business mailers, was it not?
I believe so.
So I'm assuming that business-to-consumer probably has similar differences, but this is B2B for all the B2B marketers out there who are interested in this data in particular. Stefan, talk us through what this is about.
Sure. If you look at the far left column, that shows the size of the email lists that are being targeted here, and it shows us the difference in opens and clicks for segmented versus non-segmented campaigns. And as you can see, there's really a remarkable difference in for those companies that are using segmentation. The biggest difference, and again, this is mostly for B2B marketers, the biggest difference is based on how for the smallest lists. So if you're a small technology marketer and you've got a list of under 5,000, if you're segmenting, you're getting over 50% are opening your email and almost 12% are clicking. For lists more standard size, 50 to 100,000, the difference gets somewhat lessened, but you're still looking at a 13% open rate versus a 3.7% open rate in segmented and non-segmented. I mean, it's really a tremendous
impact. That's huge. Now, I mean, these are extremely dramatic numbers. I have talked to marketers in business to consumer and other marketers in B2B and heard not always as dramatic, but absolutely there's been a significant enough difference that they said, yeah, it's worth doing.
Absolutely. I mean, the message from this chart is not you're going to be we'll be disappointed in you if you don't hit these kinds of numbers. Of course not. You know, this depends very heavily on, you know, the kinds of lists that the topic was looking at. But the underlying message that segmentation is powerful. I mean, people know that, but it really helps to see some numbers behind it.
Now, if you're a business-to-business marketer, the chances are, and this is just so true for most B2B people, that you probably wear many hats, and you're probably busy getting ready for, maybe you're doing direct mail, maybe you're even helping the trade show team, maybe you're putting on webinars, you're dealing with online ads, you're dealing with, you know, you name it, you know, marketing, MarCom for the sales team, sales search marketing, you're doing a lot of different things often because you're just in charge of everything. So having to segment, you know, you're just lucky you're getting your monthly email and newsletter out every month, and it's hard enough to do that. And yet we're saying here, segment. It really is. Look at this chart. It is worth your time. Yeah, I know that your time's stretched. It's worth it. If you're going to segment, which should the segments be? Well, when I've talked to people, the most powerful segments have tended to be, first of all, are they a current customer or are they a prospect? That's a huge difference, and yet most business-to-business marketers send out one email newsletter, and everybody in the pot gets it, whether they're a customer or a prospect, doesn't matter who they are. At least segment that much, because prospects obviously should be spoken to differently than customers. Second of all, you may want to segment by job title. And I'm not saying job title as in maybe higher or lower, but perhaps as in department. If you've got some people on the list who are, say, IT or technical people, and some people on the list who are more business line people, some people, you know, that sort of thing, they're going to care about very different things. I know that a division of HP, we did a whole case study on them last year. They had actually segmented out by industry. They'd said, oh, let's do a different newsletter for, you know, financial services as opposed to, you know, automotive. I mean, they broke out their targets by industry, and they actually found that that wasn't as powerful as segmenting by job function, because people tended to really identify with their job function in a lot of jobs more than they did with the industry they're in. Obviously, that's going to be different depending on what industry it is and your situation, but look at the job functions. They also actually found that segmenting the newsletter was valuable up to a point, because the newsletter is more of an educative, to some degree, branding vehicle. But for offer, so, you know, you could segment, but I think they ended up segmenting out to more than a dozen segments, and then they actually pulled it. They collapsed the effort down to maybe five segments again because it wasn't worth the extra work. So they just picked the ones where the segmentation made the biggest difference and focused on that. But they kept the data in their database. And then what they did was for their sales offers to that same house list, that's where they hyper-segmented. That's where the real, you know, even just sending it to 20 perfect people is worth it. Where, okay, you just ran out of, I don't know, laser toner, or, you know, you just are perfect in this particular way for this kind of server, and you tend to be in this marketplace, and you already have this other server, and therefore we're going to write extremely pointed copy with a sales offer for you. If it was broadcast offer related, hyper segmentation was worth it. So, in short, in summary, my message is at least segment into two pieces for your email newsletter, if not more, but really put your segmentation efforts behind your broadcast offers. it's absolutely worth it. Seen a lot of case study data there. Why don't we move on to slide number 11. Now, Stephen, this one says, we mail too often or do we? Now, you had just kind of scared me earlier by saying consumers thought that people who mailed frequently were spammers. Can you explain this?
Well, and some of them do see exactly that. What this chart is about, it's not so much about frequency, it's about communication with customers. So let me explain the chart because it's not that easy to decipher. What we're looking at here in the blue and the purple columns are two different kinds of marketer. The high control, the light blue, those are marketers that are offering preference centers to the people subscribing to their newsletters. And those preference centers allow folks to determine, am I getting HTML, am I getting text, what kinds of subject matter am I getting sales alerts, and in some cases even allow them to determine roughly what kind of frequency they're receiving newsletters. Now the no control, obviously that's the most of the industry. That's the part of the industry that isn't keeping in touch with folks about their email communications using preference centers. So when we look at how often these folks are mailing, we discover that it's pretty interesting. The folks who allow this high degree of control using preference centers actually mail more frequently than those who don't.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that they're asking folks, hey, how often do you want to get a newsletter? And they're saying, oh, well, send me more. But what they are finding is they're finding out what's relevant to people. And I know the word relevance getting used so much in and around email that it's almost losing its meaning. But if you think about it, it's at its simplest, a preference center lets people tell you what they care about. And if you know that and you are doing a good job of matching content to it, you're going to be. They're going to let you in more often. They're going to say, "Yeah, whenever you have communications about these subjects, I want to get them." As a result, these folks are mailing more often.
Yeah, you're right. We did a case study with it last week or the week before about Greenbrier, the high-priced resort on the East Coast. It's $600 a night for a room, and they had allowed people to segment themselves out by were they interested in like golfing or the spa or family retreats or you know different things that you could say you were interested in. And once they started doing that, they were able to mail people offers specifically, you know, stuff just for golfers or stuff just, you know, specials about the spa. And this year they're planning to do 66 mailings. Now, that's not 66 mailings for the whole enormous list. That's 66 mailings each at different frequency to different segments of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas last year they did something like 24 mailings. So by having that segmentation and allowing people to control over what content they want to receive, now Greenbrier feels safer mailing more pieces or more times, but just very explicitly relevant content to the right people.
That's absolutely true. When you do the work to figure out what people want, you're very safe in sending them that content, no matter how often it comes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I know we promised folks we'd be done before the hour, so let's jump into our tips on slide 12.
Great.
All right, well, let's pick up where we left off and talk a little bit about frequency. Some of our tips are around testing. Make sure you test frequency on your best-performing segment. You know, this is the 10, 15, maybe 20% of your list that's generating most of your clicks and conversions. You want to be very careful with these folks, but you may find that they are able to take more emails. You may find that you're over-mailing them. It's really important to keep this segment happy. The other end of the spectrum, your worst-performing segments, and those are segments that are virtually inactive, this is a sandbox. It's a place to find out, is my HTML getting filtered? Should I try text? Should I ask people direct questions? Hey, you haven't clicked in a year. You want to opt out? You know, what can we do to help you? You know, you really can't do much more to alienate the folks here. I wouldn't suggest sending them an email every day because then they're going to hit the this is spam button. But these are folks where you can really experiment. And if they choose to drop off the list, you haven't really lost much. Second, if you have one of the preference centers that we were talking about or thinking about implementing one, don't provide a way for folks to determine a specific number of emails. At least in most cases, we recommend against this. The reason is, let's say that I've got control over emails, and I say, well, you know, American Airlines, I just want one email a month. but I'm really only interested in specials flying out of New York to Hawaii. If they've already sent me one email a month, they can't send me that communication about Hawaii, and I'm not happy, they're not happy. So for responsible emailers, you've got to know what people find relevant and use sort of value statements in that preference center rather than specific control.
So topic is more important than frequency overall.
Topic and rating how important things are.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, anything you can do to get under the hood of their personal interests. And by and large, we find people willing to fill out that information.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a brand they know and trust, they're probably willing to fill it out right from the get-go. If it's a newer relationship with perhaps an unknown brand, it may be something that can happen at opt-in, but also could happen later on.
Or you can use a dynamic content system where you code each one of the links in your newsletter or offer, and if someone's always clicking on, say, the spa offer, you start adding them to the spa list.
Exactly. Finally, and this is mostly for some B2B marketers, don't send too infrequently. What we found is that response metrics tend to drop off after about once per quarter. So you think of a lot of B2B folks are sending their corporate newsletter roughly once per quarter. That's about the least frequent we would recommend. Beyond that, if you're sending once every 6 months or once a year, then response metrics can really drop off. And one caveat here is if you've got a tiny list, if you've got, you know, hundreds or under 1,000 folks, say, chances are then people will probably we notice that there's an uptick for lists that size. But, you know, that's really on such an almost a personal level that for most marketers that's not the message to take away. The message to take away is don't send less than once per quarter.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I know that this is one of your favorite slides. Let's move on to slide number 13.
Eye tracking.
And this takes a couple of examples from our eye tracking study of email.
Now, that's also included in the benchmark guide in full color.
Yes, in very full color. So for folks that aren't familiar with eye tracking, it's a way of looking in real time at how people view a page, whether that's a typical web page, shopping cart, you name it. And in this case, we looked at how they are looking at email. To interpret those eye tracking charts on the right, the deep red, that means that just about everybody looked there, and as the colors become more muted, as I'm sure you could figure out, fewer people looked there. So when you get into the almost ghost shades of very light blue, that means that only one or two people or 1 or 2% of the folks looked in that location. The red lines across, that shows the break in the page, and where people left the page. So if they scrolled down but didn't make it all the way to the bottom of the page, we see one of those red lines. So it allows us to see where they're looking, how much attention they're giving, and where they're clicking, all kinds of things about how they're really looking at our emails. Now, the number one lesson from this particular example, this is one of, I believe, 13, these are the same email. The text, the product offered, the offering, exactly the same. The only difference, the photograph of the stock photograph of San Francisco real estate at the top of the email example on the bottom. So why does it have the kind of impact that it does? Well, what it does is just about double the power of this email. As we look at metrics like how many people read how much content, how many made it to the bottom of the page, how many seconds did they spend on the page, how many clicked on the images, all of those things at least double the response of the email on top. And it all comes from the image of on the top of the page. Why is that? Because that image immediately connotes relevance to people who are opening the email, who are viewing the email. As we found in a number of studies, those first few seconds are all important. You know, our brains are able to scan information much more quickly than we can really read it. And so that photograph of San Francisco instantly tells people, okay, this is relevant. This is what it promises to be. It's about real estate. It's important to me to find out about this. This was for a test group, by the way, that was in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fascinating is when you look at the heat map of the image itself, people didn't really spend that much time with it.
No, they didn't really look at the houses at all.
A lot of them really didn't even look at it at all. They notice it in their peripheral vision. It communicates relevance, and they're off and running into the content.
But they're spending a huge amount. They're spending so much more time reading. But there's another thing that I'm noticing, which is the first major place where they're leaving after appears to be the same spot on the page. In other words, there's a large number of people just don't scroll any at all.
Right.
They just
bail.
And if you have an image and you're limiting the amount of text, the image, you know, stops the amount of text from being there. So in other words, they're able to see less text because the image took up some of that real estate. At the same time, they read more of it.
Oh, absolutely.
So that means to me as a copywriter, if I've got an image there taking up part of the space, the text near that image is going to be so heavily read that I've got to be super, super careful to put unbelievably great copy there. I can't sort of do an introduction, you know, and be polite and kind of get to the point a paragraph or two later. I've got to zap them with my first, like, you know, four words. I have to have incredibly strong copy in my first sentence. And I've got to tell you, it's awfully hard. A lot of marketers, and I get so much email, a lot of marketers, it takes them about a paragraph or two to kind of work their way into the topic, and then they get there. In particular, for newsletters, there'll often be some kind of welcome message or introductory message or, hey, it's, you know, March. It's our March newsletter again or whatever. And then they sort of get to the point with the next paragraph. You don't have that time. You really don't.
All right. Well, shall we move on to tip number three?
Absolutely. Slide number 14.
Slide number 14.
I just keep on saying this is one of my favorites. This is a data point that I had been, God, how hard did we look for this? We must have called a bazillion people saying, does anybody have data on this? And we finally got the folks over at Informs to dig this out of client records, this aggregate data across hundreds of clients, hundreds of email marketers. And this is actually data that I thought that would be very important because in the old-fashioned postal direct mail world, this has been very well known for decades that the age of a record on a mailing list, in other words, the date that a person joined a mailing list, a new mailing list, affected their response rate to future offerings. So that if I joined a list usually within about 90 days, my interest was going down, 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 down. I knew it would also show up in email, but no one's ever had data on this before. So I was so excited. This is the first time there's ever been data on this for email. Stefan, I'm sorry, can you explain this a little more thoroughly?
Sure. If we look at the bars across the chart measure open rate and click-through, dark gray open rate, light gray click-through, and the first couple of graphs on the left-hand side, those showed people who have just subscribed, people 0 to 30 days, and people who subscribed 31 days ago to 2 months ago. And you can see how much stronger the response is in that introductory period. So it's really important to take advantage of that with, you know, welcome messages that do a lot more than just say, welcome, wait, you know, 2 months and we'll send you your first issue. You really need to start strong and include real content in that welcome message, send them their first issue immediately as a follow-up. There's a lot of opportunity there. And if anything, I think that because this data reflects B2B professional newsletters, I think in most segments we would see data that's even more dramatic, and we're researching that for this year.
Yeah, if it's e-retail, I bet you it's way more dramatic.
I guarantee that it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, this also tells you, I mean, I know that people like Travelocity, who are very, very smart emailers, have been using new account autoresponders for years now, where if you just joined, if you just opted in, you actually get a series of special welcome messages. It's not just the first welcome. It's a whole series of sort of welcome to Travelocity, here's special offers, things like that, that normal, regular, been on the house list for a while people aren't getting. So new names get treated specially for a while. I've also heard that major e-retailers such as Sierra Trading Post are testing this, and it's working quite well. So I'm seeing this across industries that you can do something. In addition, Stefan, you had mentioned that even the welcome message itself can have a special offer. As well, if you're sending people, if you're in e-retail and you're sending transactional messages, such as shipping, you know, your order is received type things. You can even put an offer in a transactional message and get a pretty good response. This absolutely works.
Absolutely. All right. Trying to get in under the wire. Tip
okay,
number
sorry.
Four on slide number 15.
Uh-huh.
We already spoke to this quite a bit, so there's no need to stick around. But it's really amazing when you look at whitelisting. Only 22% of the retailers in this study are actively letting people know that they ought to whitelist. And of those, the majority aren't providing a link with instructions. So earlier, Anne was talking about the importance of putting a whitelist note in your emails. It absolutely is. Make sure to use a text link and an image, if not just a single image, because you won't make it through the filters. And if you do so, you'll be one of the few. Fewer than one in four marketers is currently asking folks to whitelist. And, boy, talk about an easy way to get past filters. This is it.
All right. Tip number five.
Writing list churn. I know a couple of these came from case studies that that you did. Would you like to speak to these, Anne?
I think my main one really was the first of all, obviously, if they're signing up and they're paying to get the email, ask for an alternate email address so you can have a backup. Almost everybody has two email addresses these days, so you might as well. Also, if you can tie your website system in with your email system, not easy for everyone. You could try a pop-up or a DHTML pop-up, which will not be blocked by pop-up filters as of now anyway, just to tell people who have hard bounced recently, hey, you know, your email's no longer working, do you want to change it? So you can, you know, by account do that. Or you can go offline. We did a case study about Duke University's Alumni Affairs Office where they actually had a very nice little in-house system that automatically spit out a printed snail mail postcard to everybody who hard bounced. And it just said, hey, you know, need to update your email stuff on our database, gave them a little link to go to, and it mailed it out to these people. And by golly, you know, of course, they were alumni, so they were interested. But they all went, changed their email address, and cleaned the list. So people will take care of that if they care about your brand and your communication. But you do need to set up systems to get that name back. All right, page number 17. This is a wonderful chart, Stefan.
All right. So we asked the question to ourselves, you know, is email the problem? And one way of looking at it is in how marketers are using the medium. And so in this chart, we've compared marketers, the average marketer, email marketer, who's just out there trying to get responses, when we compared those to marketers who are using what we'll call advanced email tactics. And that's stuff like dynamic content, offer testing, and segmentation by user detail. So these are not necessarily very expensive tactics, but they are tactics that really have an impact because the chart, this shows click rate ranges,
mm-hmm.
and if you look at the comparison, 18% of the average marketers are getting 0 to 2% click-through rate. Less about 5% of those using advanced tactics are. And if we go further over to the right and we see higher and higher click-through rate ranges, we'll see the dominance of those marketers who are using advanced tactics. 31% compared to 16% in the 11 to 15% category. That's
so if you work harder, you really, really, really do get better results.
You absolutely do. You know, this is a mature medium where you do have to work harder to differentiate yourselves from everybody else, but the tools exist to do it, and you know, having successful email campaigns is not—it's not magic, and it's not as complicated as something like you know, figuring out search marketing these days.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of data on email, and people really can get it right when they have the time and the resources to do it.
That's wonderful. Well, we're just about to hit 3 o'clock, which is the top of the hour. We're going to stick around. If you cannot stick around, we're going to answer a couple of questions that were emailed in and added to the thing. If you can't stick around, we will be mailing out an MP3 of this teleseminar to everybody, I believe, on Thursday, although it may take another day or two. So you can have a copy of that and just skip to the end and hear the answers to that. If you can't stick around, here are the answers right now. Stefan, do you have a couple of quick questions that came in?
Sure. Let's see. Here's one, and this sort of speaks to segmentation, but I've got prospects, customers, former customers, et cetera, in my database. Who should I send newsletters to? Who should I send my newsletter to? It's not really salesy. Well, in every year we ask folks what their most successful tactics are.
Mm-hmm.
Looking for tactics that aren't expensive, tactics that are just sort of procedural. And every year, one that performs very highly is the practice of splitting your newsletter by prospects versus customers, and creating two separate newsletters, one for each one of those groups. It's very straightforward, it's pretty simple, and it is extremely effective. Marketers routinely rate it as one of the top three most successful tactics.
So that's worth doing. At the same time, just because you've got prospects' names in your database, if they don't know they're going to get your newsletter, if they really haven't honest-to-God signed up expecting a newsletter, don't send it to them. Instead, contact them through another medium and ask them if they would like to get a newsletter. Work them until they say yes. What's our next question?
All right. I think this is a good one for you to answer, having just finished our buyer's guide. When is it best to employ an agency versus in-house email management?
Oh, my golly. Well, first of all, if you are unable with your in-house resources to do any one of the following things. Number one, if you're unable to do HTML and you haven't, maybe you can do a text-only message, you can whip one of those out, but it's hard to do HTML and do something good-looking, you might get an agency at the very least to create a couple of templates for you that you can manage in-house and teach you how to use them. Number two, you might get an agency to do better landing pages for you. A lot of marketers, they can do a good job with their email, but then they have a really hard time because they depend on their IT department or a web design department that's already overloaded with projects, and they go to them and say, oh, by the way, could I get a landing page? Especially for email where you're zapping out a new offer, maybe every week or two. And your in-house department maybe can't cope with that. You can go out and get an agency or a consultancy that can specialize in landing pages or can create a little landing page generator for you. Now, those pages may not exist at your main URL. They might be hosted separately, but it's a good short-term answer when your main web department's blocked off. We know that a good landing page can make such a difference. It's worth doing it any way you can. Also, if you're considering doing multivariate testing, absolutely go out of house for that. Very, very few people I know can handle a multivariate test in-house. We have heard that a lot of the top web analytics providers are now beginning to offer multivariate testing capabilities to clients, kind of rolled in with your web analytics package, mainly because it's a real hot topic right now. Everyone's going, ooh, I want to do it, Taguchi this, Taguchi that. But the problem is when I actually talk to the folks who do it, it just is so horribly complicated to test that to even know what creative is the thing that you should test and then to read the results accurately. I mean, I know a huge consumer electronics firm. I mean, if I said the name, it's a Fortune 100. You'd be like, oh, yes. They did multivariate testing, and they tried to sort of read the results, and it turned out not to be at all genuine results. It is not an easy thing to do. So go out and get somebody who's an expert, at the very least, in analyzing the results for you. Do not do that in-house unless you've got, someone with a PhD in it in-house who's going to really focus on this.
Great advice. Finally, what should I do about buying prospect lists?
Ooh. Well, I know that, first of all, we never advise, quote-unquote, straight-out buying a list because you can't buy an opt-in. I mean, the person opted in to something in particular, and unless you are that thing, you don't have permission to mail that person. So, in other words, if you're renting a list, you still have to rent under cover of the owner of the list. So, let's say you rented, Vanity Fair's email list. It better say, Vanity Fair, an offer courtesy of Vanity Fair, and here's, our lovely advertiser, this person, and please take advantage of it. If you do really want to grow your email list, though, aggressively, I know that, Stefan, you have quite a bit of data. You have a whole special section in the guide on this, on co-registration. And that's a fabulous way of buying names in a truly profoundly permission-based environment.
Absolutely. For those who are interested in co-registration, we do go into it in some depth in the study. And one of the big messages from that study was that it's really important after you've carefully selected your partners, and I can't emphasize that enough. But to really follow up as absolutely as fast as you can with new subscribers. The vast majority of co-registration programs use batch processing, so you may only get those subscriptions once every 24 hours.
Oh, golly.
Or even worse. If you're in that kind of situation, do whatever you can to accelerate the speed of that. It should really be in real time. If that's not possible, make sure that those names are processed as soon as the files come through. If you are processing those names a week later, your uptake rates are going to be much, much diminished. People aren't going to remember that they clicked the box with your name on it a week ago.
No, they really won't. Well, thank you so much for those great questions. Thank you for attending today. If you are interested in any of the data we mentioned today, feel free to call our customer service line at, and it's toll free, 877-895-1717. Ron and Sharon are always standing by to handle customer questions and phone calls. Or you can just get your own copy of the 267-page report over at SherpaStore.com. Thank you so much, and thanks for reading Marketing Sherpa. Bye-bye.